with Flashy in full fig of frock-coat and go-to-meeting roof, making my official bow to little Dalip enthroned in state. You'd not have recognized the lively imp of yesterday in the regal little figure all in silver, nodding his aigretted turban most condescendingly when I was presented by Lal Singh, who was second minister. Jawa here was nowhere in sight, but Dinanath, old Bhai Ram Singh, and Azizuddin were present, solemn as priests. It was eerie, knowing that they were all aware that their wazir had tried to murder me a few hours earlier, and that I rioted with their Maharani in this very chamber. There wasn't so much as a flicker on the handsome, bearded faces. Damn good form, the Sikhs. Behind Dalip's throne hung a fine lace curtain, the purda of his mother, the Maharani, it being the custom of quality Indian ladies to seclude themselves, when they ain't belly-dancing at orgies, that is. By the curtain stood Mangla, unveiled but most modestly dressed, and formal as though we'd never laid eyes on each other. Her duty was to relay conversation to and from her mistress behind the screen, and she did it most properly, welcoming me to Lahore, inviting blessings on my work, and finally, as Jassa had forecast, bidding me to attend His Majesty when he reviewed the Khalsa that afternoon.
"You shall ride on an elephant,"
squeaks the said Majesty, lapsing from kingly dignity for a moment, and then stiffening before the reproving glances of his court. I said gravely that I'd be honoured beyond measure. He shot me a shy little smile, and then I backed from the presence, turning and resuming my tile only when I reached the rug in the doorway, as form demanded. To my surprise, Lal Singh came after me, taking my arm, all smiles, and insisting on giving me a conducted tour of the arsenal and foundry, which were close by the sleeping palace. Since I'd spent half the night sporting with his lady-love, I found this affability disconcerting, until he took me flat aback by speaking of her with alarming frankness.
"My Jayantan had hoped to come out from Purda to greet you after the Durba," confides he. "Alas, she is a little drunk from toasting her abominable brother, in a vain effort to put some courage into him. You can have no notion what a poltroon he is. The thought of facing the Khalsa quite unmans him, even now when all is settled. But she will certainly send for you afterwards. She has important messages for the envoy of the Sirkar."
I said I was to Her Majesty's service, and he smiled.
"So I have heard."
Seeing me stare, he laughed aloud.
"My dear friend, you look at me as though I were a rival. Believe me, with my Jayantan there is no such thing. She is no one's mistress but her own. Let us fortunate fellows thank God for it. Now, you shall give me your opinion of our Punjabi muskets. Are they not a match for Brown Bess?"
At the time I was all suspicion. Only later did I realize that Lal Singh meant every word he said, and my Jayantan was the least of what he wanted to tell me that day. When we'd examined the small arms, stocked in impressive numbers, and the forges, and the casting of a great white-hot 9-pounder gun, and the rain of lead hitting the steaming vats in the shot tower, and I decreed that the Khalsa's armory compared well with our own, he took me by the arm as we walked, most confidential.
"You are right," says he, "but arms are not everything. On the day, victory and defeat rest with the generals. If ever the Khalsa took the field, it might well be under my leadership and Tej Singh's."
He sighed, smiling, and shook his head.
"Sometimes I wonder how we should acquit ourselves against such a seasoned campaigner as your Sir Hugh Gough. What would you think, Flashman Sahib?"
Wondering, I said that Gough wasn't the most scientific soldier since Boney, but he was probably the toughest. Lal Singh nodded, stroking his beard, and then laughed merrily.
"Well, we must hope it is never put to the test, eh? Now, we set out for Mayanmir in an hour. May I offer you some refreshment?"
They're so devious, these folk, you never know what they're up to. Was he hinting that if it came to war he was ready to fight a cross? Or trying a bamboozle? Or just guessing? Whatever his purpose, he must know that nothing he said could make Gough drop his guard. It was almost interesting and gave me food for thought until the horn sounded to signal the departure of the royal progress to Mayan Mir. The procession was drawn up outside the Bright's gate, and when I saw it I thought, that's India. It was Arabian Nights come to life, two battalions of the palace guard in their red and yellow silks, and in their midst half a dozen elephants, gorgeously caparisoned in blue and gold saddle-cloths that swept the ground, jewelled harness on their heads, their tusks, and even the mahout's goads tipped with gold. The howdahs were little coloured palaces, topped with minarets and silk canopies which stirred as the great beasts swayed and bellowed. The keepers quiet in them as they waited for their royal freight. Horsemen in steel casques that shone like silver in the sunlight rode up and down the elephant line. Their sabres drawn, they converged like clockwork to form a lane from the gate for porters who came bearing enormous panniers brimming with coin. Preceded by chamberlains who supervised the strapping of the panniers to the howdahs of the third and second elephants. When some of the coins fell in a tinkling shower to the dust, there was a great "Oh!" from the crowd assembled to see the show. Two or three of the horsemen leaned from their saddles, scooping up the rupees and hurling them over the heads of the rigid guardsmen to the mob, who yelled and scuffled for them. For a country that was supposed to be short of blunt, there seemed to be no lack of pice to fling to the beggars. Pice are Indian terms for coppers. Two of the chamberlains mounted the third elephant, and now came a little knot of courtiers led by Lal Singh, all brave in green and gold. They mounted into the fifth howdah, and a chamberlain who had been shepherding Jassa and me indicated that we should mount the ladder on the fourth beast. We climbed up, and as I seated myself the muted grumble of the crowd took on a new note. I knew exactly why. They were asking each other, who's the foreigner, then, who takes precedence over the royal courtiers? He must be an infidel of note. Doubtless the English queen's son, or a Jewish moneylender from Karachi. Well, give the unbelieving swine a cheer. I doffed my tile, looking out over that astonishing scene. Ahead, the great mammoths, with their swaying howdahs, and either side the horsemen, the yellow guards, and beyond a vast sea of brown faces. The walls flanking the Bright Gate were black with spectators, as were the buildings behind, with the great column of the Summum Borge towering over all. The baying of the crowd rose again, and now there was a disturbance below my elephant, the yellow line of guardsmen break in, to let in a wild figure who capered and waved to me. He was a burly Ghazi of a fellow, bandoliered and bearded to the eyebrows, yelling in Pashto, "Ay ye, bloody lance! It is I, Shadman Khan! Remember me? Salam, soldier! Heep, heep, heep! Hurrah!" Well, I didn't remember him, but plainly it was someone from the old days, so I lifted my lid again, calling, "Salam, Shadman Khan!" And he shouted with delight and yelled in English, "Stand fast, 44th!" And in an instant I was looking down on the bloody snow over Ganderbach, with the remnants of the 44th being cut down by the tribesmen swarming over their position. And I wondered which side he'd been on then. I've since remembered that there was a Shadman Khan among those ruffians who held me in Gul Shah's dungeon, and yet another among the band who saved me from the thugs at Jhansi in 57 and stole our horses on the way to Cawnpore. I wonder if they were all the same man. It has no bearing on my present tale, anyway. It was just an incident at the Bright Gate, but I think it was the same man. Everybody changed sides in the old days. Now there was a sudden hush, broken by the strains of sweet music, and out from the bright gate came a native band, followed by a tiny figure in cloth of gold, mounted on a white pony. A thunderous salaam rolled out from the waiting crowd. "Maharaj! Maharaj!" as little Dalip was lifted from his saddle by a richly clad courtier, whom I recognized with a shock as Jawahir Singh. He seemed sober enough now, and I've never seen a man grin so eagerly as he perched Dalip on his shoulder and gestured to the crowd, inviting their acclaim. They roared willingly enough, but I detected an undertone of groans which I imagined were meant for Jawahir himself. He mounted with Dalip to the first elephant, and then out from the gate stalks Gardner, staring grimly right and left, and followed by a party of his black robes guarding a palki, a litter usually curtained, beside which Mangla walked unveiled. It stopped, and she drew the curtains and handed out the Maharani Jindan. She was all in shimmering white, and although she wore a gauzy purdah veil, I believe I'd have recognized that hourglass figure anywhere. She'd got over her drunk, by the looks of it, for she walked steadily to the second elephant, and Gardner handed her up to an absolute bellow of cheering. There's no doubt about it, all the world loves Nell Gwyn. Mangla mounted beside her, and then Gardner stepped back and surveyed the procession, your good bodyguard alert for trouble. His eye passed over me and lingered for a moment on Jassa. Then he had given the signal. The band struck up a march. The elephant lurched and bellowed beneath us. And off we swayed with a great creaking of harness and jingling of outriders while the mob roared again and the dust swirled up from the tramp of the guardsmen. We skirted under the high city walls, thronged with folk who threw blossoms and shouted blessings on the little Maharaja. They were swarming like bees on the ramparts of the Kashmir Gate, and then, as we rounded the angle of the wall beneath the huge half-moon battery, there came from far ahead the report of cannon, a continuous rumble of firing, one gun after another. 180, I'm told, though I didn't count them. The elephants squealed in alarm, and the howdahs bucked from side to side so hard that we had to cling on to prevent being pitched out, with the mahouts flat on their beasts' heads, steadying them with goad and voice. As we came under the Delhi gate, the firing ceased, to be replaced by a distant, measured tread. Thousands of marching men, and I craned out to look as the procession swung away from the city and saw an astonishing sight. Coming towards us, all in immaculate line, were four battalions of the Khalsa, a solid wall of infantry, half a mile from wing to wing, the dust rising before them in a low cloud, their drummers and standard-bearers to the fore. I didn't know it then, but they were absolutely marching on Lahore to bring Jawahir out by force, having lost patience after waiting for him all day. You could almost read the purpose in the grim, inexorable approach of that disciplined host, the green jackets of Sikh infantry and the blue turbans of the Dogras on the left, the scarlet coats and shakos of regular foot on the right. Our procession slowed and half-halted, but with the howdahs of Jindan and the chamberlains in front, I couldn't see what was happening with Jawahir. I could hear him, though, shouting shrilly, and the armoured horsemen converged on his elephant, while the yellow guardsmen tramped stolidly on. Our procession forged ahead towards the centre of the Khalsa line, and just as it seemed as though we must collide, the advancing host split into two, wheeling into columns which advanced down either side of us, and I've never seen anything to match it for drill, not even on horse guards. I watched them striding by beyond our yellow guardsmen, and wondered for a moment if they meant to pass us altogether. But a burly Risaldar major came tearing out on the flank, reining in midway down the procession, rose in his stirrups, and at the exact moment bawled in a voice you could have heard in Delhi,
battalions about.
There was the tremendous 1, 2, 3, 4 crash as they marked time and turned. And then they were marching with us, a solid mass of 2,000 infantry on either flank, shakos and redcoats to the right, and blue and green turbans to the left. Well, thinks I, whether Jawa here takes it for a prisoner's escort or a guard of honour, he can't complain that they haven't received him in style. I could hear him crying, "Shabash!" in compliment, and on the elephant ahead of us the chamberlains were on their feet, scooping up rupees in little hand shovels, and hurling them over the yellow guardsmen at the Khalsa battalions. They glittered in the air like silver rain falling among the marching Sikhs, and not a man wavered in his step or even glanced aside. The chamberlains shoveled away for dear life, emptying the panniers and spraying the dust with their rupees, screaming to the troops that this was the gift of their loving monarch and his wazir Raja Jawahar Singh, God bless him. But for all the heed the Khalsa paid, it might as well have been bird droppings, and behind me I heard Jassa mutter, "Save your dollars, boys, they ain't buying you a thing." Another roar from the Risaldar Major, and the escorting battalions crashed to a halt, stock still in the swirling dust. Our procession lumbered on, wheeling left, as we emerged from between those grim ranks, and as our beast turned to follow the leaders, there, all of a sudden, on our right flank, was the whole Khalsa drawn up in review, horse, foot, and guns, squadron upon squadron, battalion upon battalion, as far as the eye could see. I'd seen it before and been impressed. What I felt now was awe. Then it had been at exercise. Now it was dead still, at attention. 80,000 men, and not a movement, except for the gentle stirring of the standards before the battalions, the flutter of pennons on the lances at rest, and the occasional tossing of a horse's mane. And it's strange, the tramp of our guardsmen and the groaning of the elephant's harness must have been loud enough to wake the dead. But all I remember now is the silence as we pass slowly before that tremendous army. There was a sudden shrill voice from the second elephant, and damn me if Jienden and Mangla weren't flinging out backsheesh too, as the chamberlains had done, and calling out to the soldiers to accept their bounty, to remember their oaths to the Maharaja, and to stand true to their salt for the honour of the Khalsa. Still not a man moved, and as the women's voices died away I felt a chill in spite of the heat of the westering sun. And then someone shouted a command to halt, and the elephants lumbered to a standstill. There was a little cluster of tents ahead beside the leading beast, and a group of senior officers before it. Akalis were moving down the line, shouting to the mahouts to dismount, and as our elephant sank to its knees I felt nothing but relief. You're uncomfortably conspicuous in a howdah, I can tell you, especially with 80,000 bearded graven images glaring blindly at you from point-blank range. There was a clatter of hooves, and there was Gardner by the second elephant, ordering servants who helped Jiendan and Mangla down, and led them towards one of the pavilions, where handmaidens were waiting to receive them. Pretty butterfly figures in silks and gauzes, altogether out of place before that great martial host in leather and serge and steel. Gardner caught my eye and jerked his head, and without waiting for a ladder I dropped to the ground with as much dignity as I could, clutching my topper in place. Jassa followed, and I saw that Lal Singh and the courtiers had also descended. I walked towards Gardner's horse and noticed that only Jawahir's elephant was still standing. He was sitting in the howdah, clutching little Dalip to him and complaining shrilly to the Akalis, who were angrily ordering his mahout to make the elephant kneel. Another order was shouted, And now the yellow guardsmen began to march away, the armored horsemen cantering ahead of them. At this, Jawahir was on his feet, demanding to know where his escort was going, shouting to his mahout not to take the elephant down. He was in a great passion, and as his head turned, I caught the gleam of the great diamond in his turban aigret. "Good Lord, that's Jandan's belly button," thinks I. "How he does get about!" And now Gardner was leaning down from his saddle and addressing me rapidly in English.
"Go and help the Maharaja down. Go on, man, quickly. It'll please the troops, make a fine impression. Get him, Flashman."
It all happened in split seconds. There I was, aware only that Jawahir was in a fine taking about the reception he was receiving, that Gardner was making what sounded like an excellent diplomatic suggestion, kindly old John Bull giving the heathen princeling a piggyback before his powers assembled, and all that. But even as he spoke, I saw that an Akali had scrambled up into the howdah and seemed to be trying to pull Dalip away. Jawahir screamed. The Akali hit him in the face. Jawahir dropped the child and cowered away. There was a zeep of drawn steel at my back, and I started round to find half a dozen Sikhs almost on top of me, tulwars drawn and yelling blue murder. I didn't wait to advise Gardner to help the Maharaja down himself. I was past his horse like a stung whippet, and ran slap into the elephant's arse, fell back with a yell of terror into the path of the charging Sikhs, made a dive to get under the elephant's trailing saddle-cloth, stumbled and became entangled, struggled free, and something hit me an almighty blow across the shoulders, driving me to my knees. I clutched wildly behind me and found myself with a little Dalip in my arms, fallen from aloft, and a mob of raging madmen hurling me aside to get at the elephant. There was a choking scream for overhead, and there was Jawahir sprawling over the side of the howdah, arms outstretched, with a spear shaft buried in his chest, blood spewing from his mouth, and showering down on me. The attackers were swarming into the howdah, slashing at him. Suddenly his face was a bloody mask, his turban slipped from his head, a great length of blood-sodden silk snaking down at me. Gardner's horse reared above me. Men were yelling and women shrieking. I could hear the hideous sound of the tulwars cutting into Jawahir's body, and still he was screaming, and blood was everywhere, in my eyes and mouth, on the gold coat of little Dalip in my arms. I tried to throw him away, but the young blighter had me fast round the neck and wouldn't leave go. Someone seized me by the arm, Jasser, a pistol in his free hand. Gardner urged his horse between us and the slaughter, knocking Jasser's pistol from his grasp and shouting to him to get us away, and I blundered towards the tents with that confounded infant hanging from my neck, and not a sound out of him either. The turban cloth had draped itself across my face, and as I dragged the disgusting thing clear and sank to my knees, Dalip still clung to me with one hand, and in the other, dripping with his uncle's gore, was the great diamond that had fallen from Jawahir's aigret. How the brat had got hold of it, God knows, but there it was, almost filling his small hand, and he stared at me with great round eyes and piped,
"Kohinoor, Kohinoor!"
Then he was whisked away from me, and as I came to my feet I saw he was clasped in his mother's arms beside the tent, bloodying her veil and white sari. "Oh, my Christ!" groans Jasser, and I looked past him and saw Jawahir, crimson from head to foot, slide over the side of the howdah and fall headlong in the dust with his life flooding out of him. And still those fiends hacked and stabbed at his corpse, while some even emptied their muskets and pistols into it, until the air was thick with the reek of black powder smoke. It was Gardner who hustled us to one of the smaller tents, while his black robes surrounded Jandan, Dalip, and the screeching women, shepherding them to the main pavilion. He cast a quick glance at the mob struggling about Jawahir's corpse, and then twitched our tent curtain shut. He was breathing hard, but cool as you please. "Well, how do you like that for a drumhead court-martial, Mr. Flashman?" He laughed softly. "Khalsa justice, the damn fools." I was a-tremble at the shocking, sudden butchery of it.
"You knew that was going to happen?"
"No, sir," says he calmly. "But nothing in this country surprises me. By the holy Eurysight, Josiah, get some water and clean him up. You're not wounded? Good. Now lie low and be quiet, both of you. It's over and done, see? The damn fools, listen to them celebrating their own funerals. Now don't you budge till I come back." He strode out, leaving us to collect our breath and our wits. And if you wonder what my thoughts were as Jasser sponged the blood from my face and hands, I'll tell you, relief, and some satisfaction that Jawa here was receipted and filed, and that I'd come away with nothing worse than a ruined frock coat. Not that they'd been out to get me, but when you walk away from a scrimmage of that sort, you're bound to put it down on Crusoe's good side, in block capitals. Jasser and I shared my flask, and for about half an hour we sat listening to the babble of shouting and laughing and feu de joie of the murderer's celebration, and the lamentations from the neighbouring tent, while I digested this latest of Lahore's horrors, and wondered what might come of it. I suppose I'd seen the signs the previous day, in the rage of the Khalsa Panches, and Jawahir's own terrors last night. But this morning the talk had been that all was well. Aye, designed, no doubt, to bring him out to the Khalsa in false hope, to a doom already fixed. Had his peacemakers, Azizuddin and Dinanath, known what would happen? Had his sister? Had Jawahir himself known even, but been powerless to avert it? And now that the Khalsa had shown its teeth, would it march over the Sutlej? Would Harding, hearing of yet another bloody coup, decide to intervene? Or would he still wait? After all, it was nothing new in this horrible country. I didn't know then that Jawahir's murder was a turning point. To the Khalsa, it was just another demonstration of their own might, another death sentence on a leader who displeased them. They didn't realize they'd handed power to the most ruthless ruler the Punjab had seen since Ranjit Singh. She was in the next tent having hysterics, so strident and prolonged that the noisy mob outside finally gave over celebrating and looting the gear from the royal procession. The shouting and laughter died away, and now there was the sound of her voice alone, sobbing and screaming by turns. And then it was no longer in her tent, but outside, and Gardner slipped back through our curtain, beckoning me to join him at the entrance. I went and peered out. It was full dark now, but the space before the tents was lit bright as day by torches in the hands of a vast semicircle of Khalsa soldiery, thousands strong, staring in silence at the spot where Jawahir's body still lay on the blood-soaked earth. The elephants and the regiments had gone. All that remained was that great ring of bearded, silent faces. And one of them was wearing my tall hat. Damn his impudence. The huddled corpse, and kneeling over it, wailing and beating the earth in an ecstasy of grief, the small, white-clad figure of the Maharani. Close by, their hands on their hilts, and their eyes on the Khalsa, a group of gardeners' black robes stood guard. She flung herself across the body, embracing it, calling to it, and then knelt upright again, keening wildly, and began to rock to and fro, tearing at her clothing like a mad thing, until she was bare to the waist, her unbound hair flying from side to side. Before that dreadful, uncontrolled passion, the watchers recoiled a step. Some turned away or hid their faces in their hands, and one or two even started towards her, but were pulled back by their mates. Then she was on her feet, facing them, shaking her little fists and screaming her hatred.
"Scum, vermin, lice, butchers, coward sons of dishonored mothers! 100,000 of you against one! You, gallant champions of the Punjab, you wondrous heroes of the Khalsa, you noseless bastard offspring of owls and swine who boast of your triumphs against the Afghans and the prowess you'll show against the British. You, who would run in terror from one English camp sweeper and a Kabuli whore. Oh, you have the courage of a pack of pie dogs. You set on a poor soul unarmed. Ah, ye, my brother, my brother. My Jawahir, my prince.
From raging, she was sobbing again, rocking from side to side, trailing her long hair across the body, then stooping to cradle the horrid thing against her breast, while she wailed on a tremulous high note that slowly died away. They watched her, some grim, some impassive, but most shocked and dismayed at the violence of her grief. Then she laid down the body, picked up a fallen tulwar from beside it, rose to her feet and began slowly to pace to and fro before them, her head turned to watch their faces. It was a sight to shiver your spine, that small, graceful figure, her white sari and rags about her hips, her bare arms and breasts painted with her brother's blood, the naked sword in her hand. She looked like some avenging fury from legend as she threw back her hair with a toss of her head, and her glare travelled along that silent circle of faces. A stirring sight, if you know what I mean. There's a picture I once saw that could have been drawn from her, Clytemnestra, after Agamemnon's death. Cold steel and brazen boobies, and be damned to you. Suddenly she stopped by the body, facing them, and her voice was hard and clear and cold as ice as she passed her free hand slowly over her breasts and throat and face.
"For every drop of this blood, you will give a million. You, the Khalsa, the pure ones, pure as pig dung, brave as mice, honored as the pandas of the bazaar, fit only for—"
I shan't tell you what they were fit for, but it sounded all the more obscene for being spoken without a trace of anger. And they shrank from it. Oh, there were angry scowls and clenched fists here and there, but the mass of them could only stare like rabbits before a snake. I've seen women, royal mostly, who could cow strong men. Ranavalona with her basilisk stare, or Irma, my second wife, you know, the Grand Duchess, with her imperious blue eyes. Lakshmibai of Jhansi could have frozen the Khalsa in its tracks with a lift of her pretty chin. Each in her own way. Jayan Dan did it by shocking them out of their senses, flaunting her body while she lashed them quietly with the language of the gutter. At last one of them could take no more of it. An old white-bearded Sikh flung down his torch and cries,
"No, no, it was no murder. It was the will of God."
Some murmured in support of him, others cried him down, and she waited until they were silent again.
"The will of God? Is that your excuse? You will blaspheme and hide behind God's will? Then hear mine. The will of your Maharani, mother of your king."
She paused, looking from one side to the other of the silent crowd.
"You will give me the murderers, so that they may pay. You will give them to me, or by that God with whose will you make so free, I shall throw the snake in your bosom."
She struck the talwa into the earth on the last word, turning her back on them and walking quickly towards the tents, Clytemnestra as ever was. With this difference that where Mrs. Agamemnon had committed one murder, she was contemplating 100,000. As she passed into her tent, the light from within fell full on her face, and there wasn't a trace of grief or anger. She was smiling. If there was one thing worse than Jawahir's murder, it was his funeral. When his wives and slave girls were roasted alive along with his corpse, according to custom. Like much beastliness in the world, Sati is inspired by religion, which means there's no sense or reason to it. I've yet to meet an Indian who could tell me why it's done, even, except that it's a hallowed ritual, like posting a sentry to mind the Duke of Wellington's horse 50 years after the old fella had kicked the bucket. That, at least, was honest incompetence. If you want my opinion of widow burning, the main reason for it is that it provides the sort of show the mob revels in, especially if the victims are young and personable, as they were in Jawahir's case. I wouldn't have missed it myself, for it's a fascinating horror, and I noticed in my years in India that the breast-beating Christians who denounced it were always first at the ringside. No, my objection to it is on practical, not moral grounds. It's a shameful waste of good womanhood, and all the worse because the stupid bitches are all for it. They've been brought up to believe it's meat and right to be broiled along with the head of the house, you see. Why, Alec Gardner told me of one funeral in Lahore where some poor little lass of 9 was excused burning as being too young, and the silly chit threw herself off a high building. They burned her corpse anyway. That's what comes of religion and keeping women in ignorance. The most educated and devout Indian female I ever knew, Rani Lakshmi Bai, thought Sati beneath contempt. When I asked her why, as a widow, she hadn't hopped on the old man's pyre herself, she looked at me in disbelief and asked,
"Do you think I'm a fool?"
She wasn't. But her Punjabi sisters knew no better. Jawahir's body was brought in several pieces to the city on the day after his death, and the procession to the ground of cremation took place under a red evening sky before an enormous throng, with little Dalip and Jayan Dan and most of the nobility prostrating themselves before the satis. 2 wives, stately, handsome girls, and 3 Kashmiri slaves, the prettiest wenches ever you saw, all in their best finery with jeweled studs in their ears and noses, and gold embroidery on their silk trousers. I ain't a soft man, but it would have broken your heart to see those 5 little beauties, who were made for fun and love and laughter, walk into the pyre like guardsmen, heads up, and not a blink of fear, serenely scattering money to the crowd, according to custom. And you wouldn't credit it, those unutterable bastards of Sikh soldiers who were meant to be guarding them, absolutely tore the money from their hands and yelled taunts and insults at them when they tried to protest. Even when they got to the pyre, those swine were tearing their jewels and ornaments from them. And when the fire was lit, one villain reached through the smoke and tore the gold fringe from one of the slaves' trousers. And these, according to their religion, were meant to be sacred women. There were groans from the crowd, but no one dared do anything against the all-powerful military. And then an astounding thing happened. One of the wives stood up among the flames and began to curse them. I can see her still. A tall, lovely girl, all in white and gold, blood on her face, where her nose stud had been ripped away, one hand gripping her head veil beneath her chin, the other raised as she damned them root and branch, foretelling that the race of Sikhs would be overthrown within the year, their women widowed and their land conquered and laid waste. And Satis, you know, are supposed to have the gift of prophecy. One of the spoilers jumped on the pyre and swung his musket butt at her, and she fell back into the fire where the 4 others were sitting calmly as the flames rose and crackled about them. None of them made a sound. I saw all this from the wall, the black smoke billowing up to mingle with the low clouds under the crimson dusk, and came away in such a boiling rage as I never felt on behalf of anyone except myself. Aye, thinks I, let there be a war, but keep me out of it, so that we can stamp these foul woman butchers flat, and put an end to their abominations. I guess I'm like Alec Gardner. I can't abide wanton cruelty to good-looking women. Not by other folk, anyway. That brave lass's malediction filled the crowd with superstitious awe, but it had an even more important effect. It put the fear of God into the Khalsa, and that shaped their fate at a critical time. For after Jawahir's death, they were in a great state of uncertainty and division, with the hotheads clamoring for an immediate war against us. And the more loyal element who'd been dismayed by Jandan's harangue at Mayanmir, insisting that nothing could be done until they'd made their peace with her, the regent of their lawful king. The trouble was, making peace meant surrendering those who'd plotted the murder of Jawahir, and they were a powerful clique. So the debate raged among them, and meanwhile Jandan played her hand to admiration, refusing even to acknowledge the Khalsa's existence, going daily to weep at Jawahir's tomb, heavily veiled and bowed with grief, and winning the admiration of all for her piety. The rumour ran that she'd even sworn off drink and fornication, a portent that reduced the Khalsa to a state of stricken wonder, by all accounts. In the end, they gave in, and in response to their appeals for audience, she summoned them not to Durbar, but to the yard under the Summum Burj, receiving them in cold silence while she sat veiled and swathed in her mourning weeds, and Dinanath announced her terms. These sounded impressively severe. Total submission to her will, and instant delivery of the murderers, but were in fact part of an elaborate farce stage-managed by Mangla. She and Lal Singh and a few other courtiers had been taken prisoner by the Khalsa at the time of the murder, but released soon after. Since when they'd been politicking furiously with Dinanath and the Panches, arranging a compromise. It amounted to this. The Khalsa grovelled to Jandan, gave up a few token prisoners, and promised to deliver Prithi Singh and the other leading plotters, who had already decamped the hills by previous arrangement, as soon as they were caught. In the meantime, would she please forgive her loyal Khalsa, since they were showing willing, and consider making war on the damn British in the near future. For their part, they swore undying loyalty to her as Queen Regent and mother of all Sikhs. To this she replied, through Dinanath, that while it was hardly good enough, she was graciously pleased to accept their submission, and hand back the token prisoners as a liberal gesture. Sensation and loyal cheers. They must now give her a little time to complete her mourning and recover from the grievous shock of her brother's death. Thereafter she would receive them in full Durbar to discuss such questions as making war and appointing a new wazir. It was a kind of face-saving settlement that's arranged daily at Westminster and in parish council, and no one's fool except the public, and not all of them either. You may ask, where was Flashy during all these stirring events? To which the answer is that, having mastered an impulse to steal a horse and ride like hell for the Sutlej, I was well in the background doing what I'd ostensibly come to Lahore for, namely, negotiate about the Suchet legacy. This entailed sitting in a pleasant, airy chamber for several hours a day, listening to interminable submissions from venerable government officials who cited precedents from Punjabi and British law, the Bible, the Koran, the Times, and the Bombay Gazette. They were the most tireless old bores you ever struck, red herring worshippers to a man. Asking nothing from me beyond an occasional nod and an instruction to my babu to make a note of that point. That kept him happy, and was good for another hour's prose, none of which advanced the cause one iota. But since the Punjabi taxpayers were stumping up their salaries, and I was content to sit under the punkah sipping brandy and soda, all was for the best, in the best of all possible civil services. We could have been there yet. My God, they probably are.
I was busy enough in my spare time, though, chiefly writing cipher reports for Broadfoot and committing them to Second Thessalonians, from which they vanished with mysterious speed. I still couldn't figure out who the postman or postmistress was, but it was a most efficient service to Simla and back. Within a week of my writing off about Jassa, a note turned up in my Bible saying, amongst other things, Number 2A2, which meant that, notwithstanding his colourful past, my orderly was trustworthy to the second degree, which meant only a step below Broadfoot and his assistants, including myself. I didn't tell Jassa this, but contrived a quick word with Gardner to give him the glad tidings. He grunted, "Broadfoot must be sicker than I thought," and passed on, the surly brute. For the rest, Broadfoot's communication amounted to little more than carry-on flash. The official news from British India, through the Vakil, was that Calcutta deplored the untimely death of Wazir Jawahir and trusted that his successor would have better luck. That was the sense of it. Along with the pious hope that the Punjab would now settle down to a period of tranquillity under Maharaja Daleep, the only ruler whom the British power was prepared to recognize. The message was clear: murder each other as often as you please, but any attempt to depose Daleep and we shall be among you, horse, foot, and guns. So, there it was, status quo, the question of the hour being, would Jayandan, for our own and Daleep's safety, give way before the Khalsa's demand for war, and turn them loose over the Sutlej? I couldn't for the life of me see why she should, in spite of her half-promise to them. She seemed to be able to deal with them as her brother had failed to do, dividing and ruling and keeping them guessing. If she could hold the rein on them while she tightened her grip on the government of the country, I couldn't see how war would be in her interest. Time would tell. A more pressing matter began to vex me as the first week lengthened into the second. Lal Singh had assured me that Jayandan was anxious to know me better, politically and personally. But devil a sign of it had there been for almost a fortnight, and I was champing at the bit. As the horrors of those first 2 days receded, the pleasures became more vivid, and I was plagued by fond memories of that painted little trollop writhing against me in the Durbar room, and strutting wantonly before her troops at Mayanmir. Quite fetching, those recollections were, and bred a passion, which I knew from experience could be satisfied by the lady herself, and no other. I'm a faithful soul, you see, in my fashion, and when a new bundle takes me fancy more than ordinary, as about a score I have done over the years, I become quite devoted for a spell. Oh, I'd done the polite by Mangler, and repeated the treatment when she called clandestine 3 nights later. But that was journeyman work which did nothing to quench my romantic lust to put Jayandan over the jumps again, and the sooner the better. I can't account for these occasional infatuations, but then neither can the poets. Uncommon randy, those versifiers. In my own case, though, I have to own that I've been particularly susceptible to crowned heads, empresses and queens and grand duchesses and so forth, of whom I've encountered more than a few. I dare say the trappings and luxury had something to do with it, and the knowledge that the Treasury would pick up any bills that were going. But that ain't the whole story, I'm sure. If I were a German philosopher, I'd no doubt reflect on Superman's subjection of the ultimate embodiment of the female. But since I ain't, I can only conclude that I'm a galloping snob. At all events, there's a special satisfaction to rattling royalty, I can tell you. And when they have Jayandan's training and inclinations, it only adds to the fun. Like most busy royal women, she had the habit of mixing sport with politics, and contrived our next encounter so that it dealt with both. On the day of her emergence from mourning for her eagerly awaited Durbar with the Khalsa Panches, I tiffened in my own quarters, and was prepared for an afternoon's drowse with the Suchet Wallers. When Mangla arrived unannounced, at first I suppose she'd looked in for another quarter-staff bout, but she explained that I was summoned to royal audience and must follow quietly and ask no questions. Nothing loath, I let her conduct me, and had quite a letdown when she ushered me into a nursery where little Dalip, attended by a couple of nurses, was wreaking carnage with his toy soldiers. He jumped up, beaming at the sight of me, and then stopped short to compose himself before advancing, bowing solemnly and holding out his hand.
"I have to thank you, Flashman Bahadur," says he, "for your care of me that afternoon."
Suddenly he began to weep, head lowered, and then stamped and dashed his tears away angrily.
"I have to thank you for your care of me,"
he began, gulping, and looked at Mangla.
"And for the great service," she prompted him, "and for the great service you rendered to me and my country."
He choked it out pretty well, head up and lip trembling.
"We are forever in your debt. Salam, Bahadur."
I shook his hand and said I was happy to be of service, and he nodded gravely, glanced sidelong at the women, and murmured,
"I was so frightened."
"Well, you didn't look it, Maharaj," says I, which was the honest truth. "I was frightened, too."
"Not you,"
cries he, shocked.
"You are a soldier."
"The soldier who is never frightened is only half a soldier," says I. "And you know who told me that? The greatest soldier in the world. His name's Wellington. You'll hear about him some day." He shook his head in wonder at this, and deciding butter wouldn't hurt, I asked if I might be shown his toys. He squeaked with delight, but Mangla said it must be another time, as I had important affairs to attend to. He kicked over his castle and pouted, but as I was salaaming my way out, he did the strangest thing, running to me and hugging me around the neck before trotting back to his nurses, with a little wave of farewell. Mangla gave me an odd look as she closed the door behind us and asked if I had children of my own. I said I hadn't.
"I think you have now,"
says she. I'd suppose that was the end of the audience, but now she conducted me through that labyrinth of palace passages until I was quite lost, and from her haste and the stealthy way she paused at corners for a look-see, I thought, we're bound for some secret nook, where she means to have her wicked will of me. Watching her neat little bottom bobbing along in front of me, I didn't mind a bit, though I'd rather it had been Jian Dan. And when she ushered me into a pretty boudoir, all hung in rose silk and containing a large divan, I lost no time in seizing her opportunities. She clung for a moment and then slipped away, cautioning me to wait. She drew the curtain from a small alcove, pressed a spring, and a panel slid noiselessly back to reveal a narrow stairway leading down. Sounds of distant voices came from somewhere below. Having had experience of their architecture, I hesitated, but she drew me towards it with a finger to her lips.
"We must make no sound," she breathed. "The Maharani is holding Durbar."
"Capital," says I, kneading her stern with both hands. "Let's have a Durbar ourselves, shall we?"
"Not now,"
whispers she, trying to wriggle free.
"Ah, no, it is by her command. You are to watch and listen. No, please, they must not hear us. Follow me close, and make no noise."
Well, she was at a splendid disadvantage, so I held her fast and played with her for a moment or two, until she began to tremble and bite her lip, moaning softly for me to leave off or we'd be overheard. And when I had her nicely on the boil and fit to dislocate herself, why, I let her go, reminding her that we must be quiet as mice. I'll learn them to lure me into boudoirs on false pretenses. She gulped her breath back, gave me a look that would have splintered glass, and led the way cautiously down. It was a dim, steep spiral, thickly carpeted against sound, and as we descended the murmur of voices grew ever louder. It sounded like a meeting before the chairman brings them to order.
At the stair foot was a small landing, and in the wall ahead an aperture like a horizontal arrow slit, very narrow on our side, but widening to the far side of the wall, so that it gave a full view of the room beyond. We were looking down on the Durbar room, at a point directly above the Purdah curtain, which enclosed one end of it. To the right, in the body of the room, before the empty throne and dais, was a great jostling throng of men, hundreds strong. The Panches of the Khalsa, much as I'd seen them that first day at Mayanmir. Soldiers of every rank and regiment, from officers in brocaded coats and aigretted turpans, to barefoot jawans. Even in our eyrie we could feel the heat and impatience of the close-packed throng as they pushed and craned and muttered to each other. Half a dozen of their spokesmen stood to the fore, Makka Khan, the imposing old general who'd harangued them at Mayanmir, the burly Imam Shah, who'd described Peshawar's death, my Riseldan major of the heroic whiskers, and a couple of tall young Sikhs whom I didn't recognize. Makka Khan was holding forth in a loud, irritated way. I suppose you feel a bit of an ass addressing 200 square feet of embroidery. To our left, hidden from their view by the great curtain, and paying no heed at all to Makka Khan's oratory, the Queen Regent and Mother of all Sikhs was making up for her recent enforced abstinence from drink and frivolity. For 2 weeks she'd been appearing in public, sober, grief-stricken, and swathed in mourning apparel. Now she was enjoying a leisurely toilet, lounging, goblet in hand, against a table loaded with cosmetics and fripperies, while her maids fluttered silently about her, putting the finishing touches to an appearance plainly calculated to enthrall her audience when she emerged. Watching her drain her cup and have it refilled, I wondered if she'd be sober enough. If she wasn't, the Khalsa would miss a rare treat. From morning she'd gone to the other extreme and was decked out in a dancing girl's costume, which in any civilized society would have led to her arrest for breach of the peace. Not that it was unduly scanty. Her red silk trousers, fringed with silver lace, covered her from hip to ankle, and her gold waistcoat was modestly opaque. But since both garments had evidently been designed for a well-grown dwarf, I could only wonder how she'd been squeezed into them without bursting the seams. For the rest, she wore a head veil secured by a silver circlet above her brows, and a profusion of rings and wrist bangles. The lovely, sullen face was touched with rouge and kohl, and one of her maids was painting her lips with vermilion, while another held a mirror, and two more were gilding her finger and toenails. They were all intent as artists at a canvas. Jian Dan pouting critically at the mirror and directing the maid to touch up the corner of her mouth. Then they all stood back to admire the result before making another titivation. And beyond the Purdah, her army coughed and shuffled and waited, and Makka Khan ploughed on.
3 divisions have declared for Gulab Singh as wazir, cries he. Courts, Avitabiles, and the Povinda. They wish the Durbar to summon him from Kashmir with all speed.
Jan Dan continued to study her mouth in the mirror, opening and closing her lips. Satisfied, she drank again, and without looking aside, gestured to her chief maid, who called out,
"What say the other divisions of the Khalsa?"
Makka Khan hesitated.
They are undecided.
Not about Gulab Singh, shouts the Riseldan major.
We'll have no rebel as wazir, and the devil with courts and the Povinda.
It was a roar of agreement, and Makka Khan tried to make himself heard. Jan Dan took another pull at her goblet before whispering to the chief maid, who called,
There is no majority then for Gulab Singh?
A great bellow of
No, and Raja Gulab,
with the leaders trying to quiet them. One of the young Sikh spokesmen shouted that his division would accept whoever the Maharani chose, which was greeted with cheering and a few groans, to the amusement of Jan Dan and the delight of the maids,
who were now holding up three long pier glasses so that she might survey herself from all sides. She turned and posed, emptied her cup, pulled her trouser waist lower on her stomach, winked at her chief maid, then raised a finger as Maka Khan shouted hoarsely, "We can do nothing until the Kanwari speaks her mind. Will she have Gulab Singh or no?" There was a hush at that, and Jian Dan whispered to the chief maid, who stifled a fit of the giggles and called back,
"The Maharani is only a woman and can't make up her mind. How is she to choose when the great Khalsa cannot—"
That sent them into noisy confusion, and the maids into stitches. One of them was bringing something from the table on a little velvet cushion, and to my astonishment I saw it was the great Koh-i-Noor stone, which I'd last seen streaked with blood in Dalip's hand. Jian Dan took it, smiling a question at her maids, and the wicked sluts all nodded eagerly and clustered round as the Khalsa fumed and bickered beyond the curtain. And one of the young Sikhs shouted,
"We have asked her to choose. Some say she favors Lal Singh."
A chorus of groans.
"Let her come out to us and speak her mind."
"It is not seemly that Her Majesty should come out,"
cries the chief maid. "She is not prepared."
This while Her Majesty, with the Dharma now in place, was flexing her stomach to make it twinkle, and her maids hugged themselves, giggling, and egged her on.
"It is shameful to ask her to break her purdah in Durbar. Where is your respect for her to whom you swore obedience?"
At this was a greater uproar than ever, some crying that her wish was their command and she should stay where she was, others that they'd seen her before and no harm done. The older men scowled and shook their heads, but the youngsters fairly bayed for her to come out, one bold spirit even demanding that she dance for them as she had done in the past. Someone started up a song about a Kashmiri girl who fluttered her trouser fringes and shook the world thereby. And then, from the back of the room, they began to chant, "Jian Dan! Jian Dan!" The conservatives swore in protest at this indecent levity, and a big lean Akali, with eyes like coals and hair hanging to his waist, burst out of the front rank, yelling that they were a pack of whoremongers and loose-livers who'd been seduced by her wiles, and that the children of God the Immortal, meaning his own set of fanatics, would stand no more of it.
"Aye, let her come out," bawls he. "Let her come humbly, as befits a woman, and let her forswear her scandalous life that is a byword in the land, and appoint a wazir of our own approving. Such a one as will lead us to glory against the foreigners, Afghan and English alike."
The rest was lost in pandemonium, some howling him down, others taking up his cry for war, Maka Khan and the spokesmen helpless before the storm of noise. The Akali, frothing at the mouth, leapt onto the front of the dais, raving at them that they were fools if they gave obedience to a woman, and a loose woman at that. Let her take a suitable husband and leave men's affairs to men, as was fitting and decent. And behind the purdah, Jian Dan nodded to her chief maid, draped a silver scarf over one arm, took a last look at her reflection, and walked quickly and fairly steadily round the end of the curtain. Speaking professionally, I'd say she wasn't more than half soused, but drunk or sober, she knew her business. She didn't sidle or saunter, or play any courtesan tricks, but walked a few paces and stopped, looking at the Akali. There'd been a startled gasp from the mob at her appearance. Well, damn it, she might as well have been stark naked, painted scarlet from the hips down and gilded across her top hamper. There was dead silence, and then the Akali stepped down from the dais like an automaton, and without another glance she continued to the throne, seated herself without haste, arranged her scarf just so on the armrest to cushion her elbow, leaned back comfortably with a finger to her cheek, and surveyed the gathering with a cool little smile.
"Here are many questions to be considered at once,"
Her voice was slightly slurred, but carried clearly enough.
"Which will you take first, General?"
She spoke past the Akali, who was glaring from side to side in uncertainty. And Marker Khan, looking as though he wished she'd stayed out of sight, drew himself up and bowed.
"It is said, Konwari, that you would make Lal Singh wazir. Some hold that he is no fit man.
But others have bound themselves to accept my choice,"
she reminded him.
"Very well, it is Lal Singh."
This brought the Akali to life again, an arm flung out in denunciation.
"Your bedman," he bawled. "Your paramour, your male whore."
There was a yell of rage at this, and some started forward to fall on him. But she checked them with a raised finger and answered the Akali directly, in the same calm voice.
"You would prefer a wazir who has not been my bedman? Then you can't have Gulab Singh for one. But if you wish to nominate yourself, Akali, I'll vouch for you."
There was a moment's stunned hush, followed by scandalized gasps, and then a huge bellow of laughter echoing through the great room. Insults and obscene jests were showered on the Akali, who stood mouthing and shaking his fists. The rowdies at the back began to stamp and cheer. Makar Khan and the seniors stood like men poleaxed. And then, as the tumult grew, the old soldier roused himself and thrust past the Akali to the foot of the dais. In spite of the din, every work reached us through that cunningly designed spy hole.
"Konwari, this is not seemly. It is to shame the Durbar. I beg you to withdraw. It can wait till another day."
"You didn't bid that thing withdraw when he brayed his spite against me,"
says she, indicating the Akali. And as it was seen that she was speaking, the noise died on the instant.
"What are you afraid of? The truth that everyone knows? Why, Makar Khan, what an old hypocrite you are."
She was laughing at him.
"Your soldiers are not children, are you?"
She raised her voice, and of course the mob roared, "No!" with a vengeance, applauding her.
"So, let him have his say."
She flirted a hand at the Akali.
"Then I shall have mine."
Makar Khan was staring in dismay, but with the others shouting at him to give way, he could only fall back, and she turned her painted smile on the Akali.
"You rebuke me for my lovers, my male whores, you call them. Very well."
She looked beyond him, and the thick, heavy voice was raised again.
"Let every man who has never visited a brothel step forward."
I was lost in admiration. The most beardless innocent there wasn't going to confess his unworldliness to his mates, and certainly not with that mocking Jezebel watching. Even Tom Brown would have hesitated before stepping forth for the honour of the old schoolhouse. The Akali, who hadn't the advantage of Arnold's Christian instruction, was simply too dumbfounded to stir. She timed it well, though, looking him up and down in affected wonder before he'd collected his wits, and drawling,
"There he stands, rooted as the Hindu Kush. Well, at least he is honest, this wayward child of God the Immortal, but not, I think, in a position to rebuke my frailty."
That was the moment when she put them in her pocket. If the laughter had been loud before, now it was thunderous. Even Makar Khan's lips twitched. And the Rissaldar Major fairly stamped with delight and joined in the chorus of abuse at the Akali. All he could do was rage at her, calling her shameless and wanton, and drawing attention to her appearance, which he likened to that of a harlot plying for hire. He was a braver man than I'd have been, with those fine eyes regarding him impassively out of that cruel mask of a face.
I remembered the story of the Brahmin whose nose had been sliced off because he'd rebuked her conduct. Looking at her, I didn't doubt it. The Akalis are a privileged sect, to be sure, and no doubt he counted on that.
"Get you gone," he bawled. "You are not decent. It offends the eye to look at you."
"Then turn your eyes away, while you still have them,"
says she, and as he fell back a pace, silenced, she rose, keeping a firm grip of the throne to steady herself, and stood straight, posing to let them have a good view.
"In my private place, I dress as you see me to please myself. I would not have come out, but you called me. If the sight of me displeases you, say so, and I shall retire."
That had them roaring for her to stay, absolutely, which was just as well, for without the throne to cling to, I believe she'd have measured her length on the floor. She swayed dangerously, but managed to resume her seat with dignity, and as some of the younger men started to hustle the Akali away, she stopped them.
"A moment. You spoke of a suitable husband for me. Have you one in mind?"
The Akali was game. He flung off the hands, pulling at him, and growled,
"Since you cannot do without a man, choose one. Only let him be a sirdar,
as a chief,
or a wise man, or a child of God the Immortal."
"An Akali?"
She stared in affected astonishment, then clapped her hands.
"You are making me a proposal. Oh, but I am confused. It is not fitting an open durbar to a poor widow woman."
She turned her head bashfully aside, and of course the mob crowed with delight.
"Ah, but no, Akali. I cannot deliver my innocence to one who admits openly that he frequents brothels and chases the barber's little girls. Why, I should never know where you were. But I thank you for your gallantry."
She gave him a little ironic bow, and her smile would have chilled Medusa.
"So, you may keep your sheep's eyes this time."
He was glad to escape into the jeering crowd, and having entertained them by playing the flirt, the fool, and the tyrant in short order, she waited till they were attentive again and gave them her speech from the throne, taking care not to stutter.
"Some of you call for Gulab Singh as wazir. Well, I'll not have him, and I'll tell you why. Or I could laugh him out of your esteem by saying that if he is as good a statesman as he was a lover, you'd be better with Baloo the clown."
The young ones cheered and guffawed, while the older men scowled and looked aside.
"But it would not be true. Gulab is a good soldier, strong, brave, and cunning. Too cunning, for he corresponds with the British. I can show you letters if you wish, but it is well known. Is that the man you want? A traitor who'll sell you to the Malki Lat in return for the lordship of Kashmir? Is that the man to lead you over the Sutlej?"
That touched the chord they all wanted to hear, and they roared, "Khalsa ji!" and "Wa guru ji ko fateh!" clamouring to know when they'd be ordered to march.
"All in good time,"
she assured them.
"Let me finish with Gulab. I have told you why he is not the man for you. Now I'll tell you why he is not the man for me. He is ambitious. Make him wazir, make him commander of the Khalsa, and he'll not rest until he has thrust me aside and mounted to my son's throne. Well, let me tell you, I enjoy my power too much ever to let that happen."
She was sitting back at ease, confident, smiling a little as she surveyed them.
"It will never happen with Lal Singh. because I hold him here.
She lifted one small hand, palm upwards, and closed it into a fist.
He is not present today by my order, but you may tell him what I say, if you wish, and if you think it wise. You see, I am honest with you. I choose Lal Singh because I will have my way, and at my bidding he will lead you.
She paused for effect, sitting erect now, head high.
Wherever it pleases me to send you.
That meant only one thing to them, and there was bedlam again, with the whole assembly roaring, Khalsa Ji! And Jayan Dan! As they crowded forward to the edge of the dais, bearing the spokesmen in front of them, shaking the roof with their cheers and applause, and I thought, by God, I'm seeing something new. A woman as brazen as she looks, with the courage to proclaim absolutely what she is and what she thinks, bragging her lust of pleasure and power and ambition, and let 'em make of it what they will. No excuses or politician's fair words, but simple, arrogant admission. I'm a selfish, immoral bitch out to serve my own ends, and I don't care who knows it, and because I say it plain, you'll worship me for it. And they did. Mind you, if she hadn't promised them war, it might have been another story, but she had, and she'd done it in style. She knew men, you see, and was well aware that for everyone who shrank from her in disgust and anger, and even hatred at the shame she put on them, there were 10 to acclaim and admire and tell each other what a hell of a girl she was and lust after her. That was her secret. Strong, clever women used their sex on men in 100 ways. Jayan Dan used hers to appeal to the dark side of their natures and bring out the worst in them. Which, of course, is what you must do with an army once you've gauged its temper. She knew the Khalsa's temper to an inch, and how to shock it, flirt with it, frighten it, make love to it, and dominate it all to one end. By the time she'd done with them, you see, they trusted her. I saw it happen, and if you want confirmation, you'll find it in Broadfoot's reports, and Nicholson's, and all the others which tell of Lahore in 45. You won't find them approving her, mind you, except Gardner, for whom she could do no wrong. But you'll get a true picture of an extraordinary woman. Order was restored at last, and their distrust of Lal Singh was forgotten in the assurance that she would be leading them. There was only one question that mattered, and Makka Khan voiced it.
When, Kundwari, when shall we march on India?
When you are ready,
says she.
After the Dasara.
That's a 10-day festival in October, after which the Sikhs were accustomed to set out on expeditions. There were groans of dismay and shouts that they were ready now, which she silenced with questions of her own.
You are ready? How many rounds a man has the Povinda division? What remounts are there for the Gorachara? How much forage for the artillery teams? You don't know? I'll tell you. 10 rounds, no remounts, forage for 5 days.
Alec Gardner's been priming you, thinks I. It silenced them, though, and she went on.
You won't go far beyond the Sutlej on that, much less beat the Sirkar's army. We must have time and money, and you have eaten the treasury bare, my hungry Khalsa.
She smiled to soften the rebuke.
So, for a season you must disperse the divisions about the country and live on what you can get. Nay, it will be good practice against the day when you come to Delhi and the fat lands to the south.
That cheered them up. She was telling them to loot their own countryside, you'll notice, which they'd been doing for 6 years. Meanwhile, she and their new wazir would see to it that arms and stores were ready in abundance for the great day. Only a few of the older hands expressed doubts.
But if we disperse, Kunwari, if we leave the country open to attack, says the burly Imam Shah, the British can make a chapao,
a sudden attack, and be in Lahore while we are scattered.
The British will not move.
says she confidently.
"Rather, when they see the great Khalsa disperse, they will thank God and stand down, as they always do. Is it not so, Makka Khan?"
The old boy looked doubtful. "Indeed, Konwari, yet they are not fools. They have their spies among us. There is one at your court now."
He hesitated, not meeting her eye.
"This Iflasman of the Shirkar's army, who hides behind a fool's errand, when all the world knows he is the right hand of the black-coated infidel."
This was the Afghan nickname for George Broadfoot.
"What if he should learn what passes here today? What if there is a traitor among us to inform him?"
"Among the Khalsa?"
She was scornful.
"You do your comrades little honor, General. As to this Englishman, he learns what I wish him to learn, no more and no less. It will not disturb his masters."
She had a way with a drawled line, and the lewd brutes went into ribald guffaws. It's damnable the way gossip gets about, but it was eerie to hear her talk as though I were miles away when she knew I was listening to every word. Well,